down the railroad track. It makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. That lonesome train, I love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. Many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Railroad train, a good old pal to me. Take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
Monk, Prairie Monk, WAFT, Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. Today is Mother's Day. This is May the 12th, 2019, and this is the Prairie Monk program, WAFT's weekly look at conservation, rails, trails, and greenways, and whatever Dave has been up to for the last week or so.
I was going to do a program that we have already recorded with Jason Bleach from Pheasants Forever. We haven't put pictures into it yet, and we will have to do that. And I thought there were so many things happened this week that I would do this week and do that one next. My mother, I have reported on her some, but really my... Mother and father were a team, so it's very hard to separate the two. My mother was English from London, Cockney London. Some of her relatives were from Colchester. She went to a palace school where the steps were so worn that they were like 5 inches lower in the middle. And her mother's family were artists, and her father was a tailor of note on Savile Row, which is a tailor row in London. It was a continuation of the colonial era, when the sun never set on the British Empire. Many other countries were doing the same sort of thing, and citizens of England were encouraged to go to the various continents for the interest of the colonials, but also for their own life and interests. And my grandfather decided to go to Australia, and they took a ship out of England, I think over Ireland and around in a circuitous route to avoid newly established German submarines in World War I. And they went around the Cape of Good Hope and eventually settled in Sydney. My grandfather was a tailor, and my mother studied. She was 13 and maturing, and she studied art then, since she was also a seamstress with my grandfather. She worked with a woman named Millie Thornborough, who owned a group of seamstresses, and her job was to sketch high-end fashions at the races and then convert them into a middle-level fashion that was somewhat simplified. And mother had something like 13 seamstresses to work with, and she had to not only record the model, but to create the second level fashions. My father had a different background. He'd been in Australia for some time, and my father was a Congregational pastor, and he met up with my mother there. After 5 years of doing that, he decided that he was not as godly oriented as his population or his audience, his congregation. And so he left the church to go school teaching. And so my mother and father married, and he was assigned, Australians assigned their school teachers to a fairly remote area of New South Wales, where there were retired copper mines, and the citizenry that went with copper mining in the retirement, surrounded by graziers who were much more wealthy, and usually sent their children to public schools in Sydney. And so it was different populations. My father taught there for quite some years, and then he had a little farm associated with the schoolhouse, and was a responsible for voting behavior and things like that. The facility was there, one teacher school, a little farm and cow and oats and pet kangaroo, and they were very much a part of the community. My father bought one of the early cars in the area so that they could move into town, which is about 10 or 15 miles away, and very hard to get to because the roads weren't very well made. After about 5 years, my father was invited to teach nearer to the coast, and he accepted that situation, and mother was a sewing teacher, and father taught school, but he also taught carpentry manual arts. And once again, we had a small farm and utilized a commons that was nearby. And so eventually we had cows. And our own butter and vegetables and fruit trees. Eventually, the school system decided to consolidate schools, so my father had to move to the Clarence River, and once again they were part of the community. And so I am inordinately respectful of what my parents contributed to my future, a fair amount of independence and innovation and artistry and friendship within the community. So I think that's enough to remind us that we all have parents and that they give us a lot, and sometimes you miss them when you move to a different place. I miss my family, and my family missed me. And that's part of doing things that are interesting and exciting. I got involved with prairie preservation and found that rather challenging but productive format, and so I relate that from time to time. This week has been a rather exciting week. One of the most exciting parts of it was Grand Prix Friends had a sale at Lingard Square, and when I went at 8 o'clock, the 20 or so tables were all green. By the time it was 11 o'clock and the sale went to 1 o'clock, there were about two tables with a few plants left. And this says something about the current move to think about your gene pool, think about pollination, think about the rate at which we're losing our gene pool. And so that was rather rewarding. I was looking for wetland species because our little pocket prairie that's been replaced by a beer garden is in a fairly wet location, and so we could use some wetland species. Grand Prairie Friends doesn't exactly have a lot of wetland species, but that will happen too. We started this. We used to grow and sell plants many years ago, and then we spun off the Grand Prairie Friends, and they have done very, very well without our helper involvement, but it's but with an interesting eye in the background. And so they planted a lot of trees lately in Coles County, and have morphed some into forestry. And they still have a lot of commitment to prairie and that gene pool. And one of the wonderful things of going to the plant sale is that you start to meet people that you've known for a long time, and there's a camaraderie there. And a lot of the things we do, you can't do unless you have that camaraderie. Not only were the Grand Prairie Friends there, but bonsai people were there, the African violet people were there, and there was the herb society was there. And all these people contribute to the overall cause of providing pollinators and facilities for insects. We have to have some connectivity, and you can imagine that people walking out with five or six plants are making a connectivity in this community.
Quick question. What's the advantage to paying? I'm sure it costs extra to buy a plant that somebody else has sprouted and you've got it in some soil versus buying a good quality mix of prairie seed.
A very good question. There is no real guarantee that a prairie mix will have be typical for your area. If it's collected in Texas, it may be Texas-oriented. If it's collected other places, it may be heavy on instant gratification. So you may have species that are going to survive. So there is no real accreditation of these seed mixes, and except that you get to know the agencies that do it well. We work with Prairie Moon in southern Minnesota, which has a lot of Illinois gene pool, and so you can be very well assured that they have responsible seed, and they give you an idea of how many seeds per whatever area. Some seeds are very small, some seeds are very large, and so if you plant switchgrass, you can have a lot of switchgrass growing, whereas other plants, just a few. So they do this, and they also progeny test. Seeds are a little variable in how they grow. So one of the things you do is to take a sample of the seed and see how many seeds germinate, so that you're not only providing seed, but you're providing seeds that grow. And that's a task which takes time, but it's rather rewarding, and it satisfies your concern about what where you get the seed and how you get the seed.
So what you're paying for when you pay all the extra to get these things from the plant societies and whatever is they may have spent years germinating these things and growing them to the point that you actually buy them. It's not like they just planted it last fall and here it is for you today.
No, you can do that. You can plant fairly quickly and get the plants grow. Grand Prairie, for instance, does have pots that are fairly well established, and that is better for you, especially if you're in an urban setting, because seed takes sometimes 10 years to grow, and so putting in a prairie requires an awful lot of tolerance and patience, because it doesn't grow quickly, and in the early stages there's a leftover amount of weeds there, and so the weed seeds do very well, and you have to have certain techniques. One of the techniques is to have fairly firm soil, so you plant the seed into firm soil. The prairie seed is used to firm soil, and you make sure that you don't put in fertilizer, because fertilizer will encourage the weeds, and the soft soil will encourage the weeds. So a little bit of attention to how you plant is helpful. If you have a large area, you have to do the seeds, and then you have to have a drill that will drill the seeds in, and it's a specialized drill. Fluffy seed doesn't drop down droppers like corn or soybeans. It has to be pushed down, and the dropper corridor has to be large, and then you have to firm the soil over it. So special drills, one's known as TRUAC, and there are other forms of drill, but the regular farm drill that drops seed down because a cup comes around and drops out a seed at a time are not effective as planting of pasture grasses or prairie. You also can roll the area after you established, and that's very helpful because, once again, the weeds don't like to be in firm soil, and the prairie can do quite well in firm soil. you plant it in the middle of winter, mostly, so that the seed drops through the snow and finds a place to grow and gets some roots. The roots grow first. You won't see the tops for a while. And then if the weeds grow, and they will grow, you wait till they get to be almost seeding and mow them. And that is another helpful technique. If you're in a small area at home, you can put down a plastic cover, which will burn out the weeds, so there's no gene pool there to compete with. But many people buy some prairie plants, and they might have a compass plant or a clover or something, and then have all sorts of other cultivar plants with them. The pollinators, people are more generous with including cultivated species. The remnant prairie people like myself are much more concerned about preserving the dignity of a pure plot of prairie. Not that there's much pure plot left, and it's probably associated with invasive species like teasel or autumn olive or other creatures. Some of those sorts of questions come up when you wander around, and so I enjoyed being there just for that reason. I was talking to people who are concerned about planting trees but not planting shrubs. That means that part of the ecosystem, part of the gene pool, is not preserved. And so how do you collect the seeds for shrubs, for instance? Joe Pye weed, it likes to grow where it's on the shade of the edge timber. Other plants are in the same boat. The Grand Prairie Friends actually had skunk cabbage there, so I have a skunk cabbage ready to plant. But some of these plants need the trees, and you can't have bellwort out in the middle of sun, full sun. So there's some plants that we can't buy for the Second Street dig because there's not a tree that shades. Whereas in the pocket prairie, we had trees that shade so we could get the understory herbs like Solomon seal and the bloodroot and ginger. It was kind of fun. I met up with someone who was working with the master naturalist, which David has been involved with, and they recognized me and said they'd taken a tour of the pocket prairie some years ago, and I'd given them a sprig of ginger, and they have grown the ginger, and they had photographs on the cell phone to show me. And so I had said that we'd lost our ginger and bloodroot and all those plants that need shade. And she said, you could get your own ginger back from me. I'll give you a sprig. But her comment to her friend was that this event was what started her to get involved with natural history and get involved with master naturalists and other things. And so that sort of raises the confidence some, because you're never quite sure what you're doing will go anywhere or do anything. But I was meeting people who had me as a TA in botany in the 60s and wanted to say that they listened to West or listened to a Prairie Monk show regularly, and that again is helpful, because we don't have a Nielsen rating on who listens to WEFC. We just know by encountering people who talk to us. I talked to my electrician who was working with violets indoor violets, and then I went to the bonsai booth, and there was a gentleman who comes from Strawn, which is north of Gibson City, and he had a very large ginkgo, which was bonsai'd, and he told me that this tree was a sprout from a tree that his grandmother had, and so it's part of the family, and we find this all the time. Just lately, we've been watching two trees on the corner of Race and University, where there's going to be a fast food chain, or I'm not quite sure what it is, but those two trees are now gone. But people have taken the seedling trees and have them growing so that the tree will be around. Other people I just ran into were people who are concerned about the coal mining efforts in the southeast of Champaign County and the southwest of Dominion County, where the mine has been approved in the last little while. And also with the fly ash that has been buried years ago, but is leaching into a clean water stream. And so we have that sort of discussion. We're also thinking of doing some more visual work with Urbana Public Television. And that has been working out, because we can't always get people to come on the weekend because they're so involved with other people at that time, whether they're naturalists or with a church or doing other things. So to be able to have access to recording the program and then putting it on railroad radio. So we had some interesting conversations about the widths of trails. I'm very much into the gene pool, and we're losing it. And at the international level, there's been a lot of concern. We're losing species at a tremendously rapid rate. And is that good for humans? Essentially, no. And it encourages a climate change, which is not recognized in every circle. But so what do we do to reduce the size of the trail? Well, part of the money that comes to the like of Kickapoo Trail is $12 million, mainly to save the corridor as a railroad. So it's an interim trail use. If you notice that the wide trail is not because of that federal money, but it's because of other federal money that wants to have wide trails. And it's also state money. So if we're down to 0.01% of our remnants around, what do we do to try and preserve the dignity of our genetics? Perhaps the horrible thought is that we might not be able to accept the funds. Can we put a trail in without necessarily having a wide trail? How do you balance off the risk of creosote and EPA saying you have to cap the area and cap it down the sides of an embankment and take out the prairie? So where does your gene pool come into conflict with the recreation? So you have to have organizations like George Fell and the National TNC, the Nature Conservancy, which had some of its formation right here in Champaign-Urbana. And we've lost that history, because that prairie that George Phil cut his teeth on, is now gone. So the history is gone. And that's important, to have a place where you can say, these biologists, Bessel and Shelford and Kendi, and before that Coles and his daughter Watts, and an ecological union. So here is history that we can very easily destroy. So when George Fell lost out in his Nature Conservancy to a group that wanted to do something with special with Long Island, a little barrier island there, George lost his situation there, came back to Illinois, and for 23 years worked with the state, but also created all these other subunits of TNC. Part of that was to create a forest preserve, and the forest preserve decided it wanted recreation in there, so the forest preserve have more mandate to do recreation. So thus the drive for wide trails. Then on the other hand, that was rectified some by the creation of a conservation district, and the conservation district has a little bit more mandate to do preservation. So we may have more success with the narrow trail in Vermilion County. A lot of this depends on politics and running over to Springfield and meeting with people so that they understand what the issue is. And if you're planting trees in Cole County, that doesn't mean to say that you're avoiding 94% prairie in Champaign County. Coles County also is part of that two-thirds of the state that was mostly prairie. And so when you plant trees, you're also not planting prairie, and you're often on prairie soils. So we have to think about those things. But I found it rather nice to be dealing with, not dealing with, but just running into people and talking and chatting. One of the people who used to work at the hardware store down the road is a bonsai person. And when I went there to get some hardware, I talked to the person on the cash register, and he said that at the Taste of Champagne, the bonsai person was there with a huge bonsai plant. And so that sort of conversation back and forth is very good. We need to have enough of that to not only gather skills, but to gather skills with a purpose, how to do it. It's less of what you have, but it's what you do with what you have. It's how do you do it, and how do you do it with a twinkle in the eye and with all these friends and relatives, including the cashier at the hardware store. And it's not always easy. You have set up, whether it's colonial or whether it's church or whether it's politics, there's been a tendency to have a few people in control and rules. And the future generation is beginning to get to be a little worried about that, because the rules of the game mostly were consumptive. They would take out a forest for their masts for ships, or we tend to not have too much biodiversity in agriculture. We have rules that are established, but some of the most fun things in life are asking questions about rules. And later in the day, I had a conversation with my friend Tom Scott, who's a railroad engineering, and he is creating the Champaign, Havana, and Western Railroad in the hope of getting historic trains into Champaign. that I want to have people have the ability to walk down a railroad bed that is not used but few times a year, because it's very costly to run a steam engine on a line. You have to have the fuel, you have to have a maintenance to maintain a very old machine, and you can only do it a few times a year. And I want the bicycles and the hikers to be able to use that corridor and to see the nature on either edge. I don't want them to have to walk through to St. Joe with corn and soybeans on the edge. I would like to see the prairie expressing itself. And if you go down to Shady Rest, I want to see the trees and the river. And I can't feel happy about assigning that area to only the railroad. Now, if you maintain it only as a railroad, you're going to have people in the next 200 years are going to walk down that corridor anyway. So how do you work with attorneys to establish new rules of the game? It's not easy if you go to work with the railroads and you want to burn a corridor. You're going to have to talk to 15 attorneys, and you probably aren't going to succeed. So young people who are out there at high school age asking questions about their future are also going to have many less resources than their great-grandparents or even their parents and grandparents. So we're looking on young people to express themselves, to have that ability to dream and go off in that direction. You have to still have some rules of the game. You probably need a mentor, someone who has some bright ideas, but is very willing to let the young folk take an interest. And sometimes it's just brother and sister having an interest and then sharing it. So I'm thinking of someone who's an electronics person, and his sister is following in the same vein. And there has been a mentorship of the parents there that is really rather wonderful. So we're looking at that. I was writing notes because I don't remember all this, and it gets to be a little disjunct. Let me see about the time. It's 20 minutes. Lots of other things have been happening. We have recycling this week. Electronic recycling. Then you have to think about all those people who recreate those new internet machinery and whatnot, and we're all responsible for having to recycle them. So on Saturday there will be a recycling, and I've been looking through some of our accumulated computer equipment, and actually Brett came in and had a look at some of it. And sometimes we have to think about recycling, reusing. And so Brett has a friend in Chicago who takes old Macs and puts them together. And so if you have a tower that you think might be useful, there are companies that reuse things. Sometimes we go back to original species because the species that we have may be too demanding, or it may be that you went out of wrinkly-bodied sheep because they got blowfly in the wrinkles, but there may be a reason for that. So there may be a study of the fibers that were there. So we have to sometimes look back in order to go forward. And And almost this becomes a spirituality. It becomes people who meet with each other, and whether they're in herb society or bonsai or cranberry friends, it's a matter of spreading across a biodiversity. And thankfully, in the last 20 years, you have places like Beckman that have teams, groups. It's realized that you can't do Netscape or Plato or these things without you bring together a lot of different people who have different ideas. Then you need to do enough in-house lectures or seminars or lab work to get your amount of knowledge together, and then you can take off. You can't just jump into these fields without some basic knowledge of the history. So mentors who give the history and inspire people to move in different directions that might be quite different from what the mentor is oriented to. We're looking for those sorts of people, and we're looking for more groups. And the universities are moving in that direction. That means that this is difficult to have a lot of people sitting around in a classroom. So if you go to the Natural History Building, they now have classrooms with large tables that five or six people can sit to, and connections to the internet, and the teacher is wandering around as a mobile mentor, but less as a dignity figure spouting information that has to be remembered in rote. So you're trying to get away from the rote. I was talking to Kevin Elliott, and I was asking how do we, now we do brain research, and we're finding that people with ADA and other problems like that often have strong talents in other directions. So how can you take that sort of person and know them long enough, talk to them long enough to know what are their strengths? And gradually you find that people with Alzheimer's whom you thought might not have any skills at all will listen to music that they knew in their teens, and if you play it, they can hear it and they can play to it. So we're looking for those sort of interactions. Now, there was another happening this week. I have a dead refrigerator, and I tried to pass it on to some of the university people who are aware that old refrigerators, even though they mightn't be efficient in some ways, are very efficient in others. Some of them used to have their compressors on the top so that the cold air goes down. I didn't succeed. So I've got a dead refrigerator. Ameren is giving $50 for a dead refrigerator. It has to be a live refrigerator in this case. And they're trying to reduce the inefficiency of old refrigerators. So they will give you $50 if you retire an old refrigerator to improve the environment. But this one is dead. We have to remove the doors and bring it out. What are you looking at? You're looking at Freon, and Freon will change the nature of the world around you and cause gaps in the environment above us. It's legitimate when you take a refrigerator to a junkyard that you have to pay for the removal of the Freon. Now, if the Freon has leaked out, then you have the chance of recycling without having to pay for freon removal. That's a little sad in a way to know that the freon has leaked. These days we have something different from freon for the freezing part of the refrigerator. But you have to think about that. You have to think about whether your refrigerator actually works or not, and get it out into a sensible place. I had a phone call from Ron Sleater in Decatur. He helps to spot herbicide the Teasel at Rantoul, and that's tremendously helpful. He's been listening to some of our programs, and he wants to remind me that you need to say much more about the gene pool. If we don't have connectivity, if we don't have some of our railroad beds and vegetation on either side, you're going to lose it, because the butterfly that's there is not going to be moving to other places and finding genetic strength. The railroad beds are narrow, but they also allow some of this sort of connectivity. And we have to keep saying gene pool, gene pool, gene pool, because we're so deficient in that pool that really has been destroyed a lot by farming. I met one young woman who is working with May Barenboim, who used to be on WEFT, and she is looking at the rhizobia, or the not so much the rhizobia, but as the microorganisms in the soil, and so she will be doing a degree in that. And once again, you're trying to innovate, discover, exercise your brain to find out what might happen, and to enjoy doing that, and in such a way that your achievement is not just a manual achievement, but it's something that takes you and others on to a new dimension. And so we are happy on the Pope Prairie area, because the road that was behind it was constantly dumped, and the Department of Transportation put two huge roadblocks at each end of the trail and closed the road. We said, excuse us, but how do we get access to our prairie? And so they came back with a $2,000 gate, which is very heavy duty. It's a tandem truck is not going to push its way through it. And motorcycles may go around it, but a fence on either side it denies that. So that's a very friendly thought. So you have Stephanie Dobbs, who's with the Department of Transportation and has responsibility for roadside natural history. It's awkward, because we discovered a rotary mower in the 40s, and after that, rotary mowing has become a social rule. And if we have prairie on the roadsides, you could often have people calling in to say, why isn't that mown? We have to explain to those people that it's not mown for a purpose. And Stephanie Dobbs and her crew of people, often township supervisors and the like, are putting in signs. So if you go from Rantoul to Paxton, there's lots of signs on the roadside to say prairie preservation. And there are also signs to remind motorcycles that there is an old Route 45, which is nice for having motorcycles fly at 50 miles an hour, but there's a limit to what you can do with that. So once again, the Department of Transportation has been very cooperative in putting up signs that say, keep your off-road vehicles off of this. And part of the reason is that sometimes those motorcycles come to a culvert and they try to jump the culvert and don't succeed. So there's a liability problem, and we're sympathetic with that. Let's take a moment here to think.
With only 8 minutes to go, I'll jump in and say, you're tuned in to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and this is the Prairie Monk Program, WEFT's weekly look at conservation in natural areas, and again, whatever Dave has been doing.
Just reminding you that gate that I was talking about allows us to take water and herbicides and tools into the prairie. I took the other day a video record of some of the areas that have been dumped fairly seriously to the point that there's a big mound and a lot of lumber and assorted concrete, and we would like to smooth that out some. We don't want to create a totally uniform landscape, but there are mounds there that need to be moved. So we've been talking to Joel McDonald, who's a landscaper, and we've been talking about getting a high hoe in there and doing some smoothing out, and that also allows less the growth of invasive species in the nooks and crannies that we can't get to. Just to say something nice about the street, we have a street that is being gentrified, and this week, for the last 2 weeks, huge high hoes have been carefully taking out portion of the News Gazette building. It's been bought by CoFusion, and they've been taking the concrete off the front. It was really an abortion of an addition on the front of the building that just opposite WEFT. And then there's one that faces the Chestnut Street, and they're in the middle of removing that. And it's releasing the archways and the parts of these old buildings. Where the one to the north was a harness repair shop, and the one to the south has been a grocery store. If you could look at the imagery on the front of it, you can see that there were lemons and potatoes and things announced on the front of the beams that go vertically. There were nice little urns on the roof. We would hope that in the long run those might be replaced. But it's interesting to watch the workmen work and try to do their best to not destroy adjacent buildings. And the poor tap has now planted regular landscaping, which pleases me a lot, because they had offered to do some prairie pleasant preservation work there, or just to plant some typical prairie plants. But I think it's like the one-time mayor of Champaign, Dan McCollum, said, when's a prairie not a prairie? It's when it's downtown Champaign. Mm. So we enjoy that relationship. It's a little different from what we expected, but the administration of the poor, the three people involved, they've been very helpful and doing what they can do within the framework of serious gentrification. And the confusion here, people are doing the same thing, but it's almost awe-inspiring to see how people can use huge equipment to remove a brick at a time or several bricks at a time and to preserve the steel beams and the like. So it reminds me that when I go to a city meeting and we're talking about a 250 million development around this MTD building and south of University down to Springfield, I have to ask, will these be LED buildings? Will these be buildings that are sustainable? Will they be buildings that you can take apart in 200 years' time and know that the materials can be recycled? I don't know that we've got to that question yet, and that development is still waiting for the university to decide whether it wants to put in a ice hockey rink that will help provide a visitor center for Champaign, which will allow venues to come here and have enough room to express themselves and have enough room to accommodate people. I also had an interesting letter from a Chinese group. They do offshore drilling, and they have asked if we could organize them a tour for a week in August that would bring three people and an interpreter here. And I'm not sure how they got hold of us, but it's probably because we've been putting our information on Facebook. So I'd assume that they have a biology interest, but they may have a sociology interest or engineering interest, and because they're engineers. So do we find people who can organize that sort of tourism? I passed the letter on to Grand Prairie Friends because they're doing a lot of things. They're getting a lot of volunteers. They're doing interesting things, and this might be just one of those things that they might be able to do, is organize a field trip for people. And it not only helps people coming in to have a look at our ecosystem, but often I ask Eastern people what their ecosystem is, and they don't always know a lot about it. So when we teach indirectly or informally here, we might have a small influence on how people go back to China or other places and look at their ecosystem and how it survives. And so how we
less than a minute.
So I think that is enough. I have a glance. One more. I think that's enough. This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. And let's see, the views and opinions expressed are solely those of the speakers and no one else. And we're coming up on noon, and that means it's time for Shruti, Music of India. No theme song music going out this time. I guess we could probably squeeze in just a couple of seconds of it here before we're done. There you go. And again, we've got Shruti Music of India coming up next here on WEFT. We are community radio for East Central Illinois.